First, how many people were not here last week? Just happened to drop in because it was Thursday. And okay, good. So that's fine. So we're going to review a little bit about what these hindrances are and everything. And we'll do this every week, just so that it's each talk is kind of self-contained. So the hindrances are a group of five kind of mental conditions that pop up all the time for yogis. And they're called hindrances because they keep us from meditating. They show up in a lot of other places too, but that's where they got their name. When the Buddha was describing what yogis do, their meditative life, they observe the precepts, etc. Then they sit down and they get rid of these hindrances. And the hindrances are sensual desire, aversion, sloth and torpor, that's being tired and not trying, restlessness and remorse, just being all fidgety and worrying about something else, and then doubt. And but when people talk about the hindrances, it can cover a lot of ground. You can talk about the hindrances as, okay, I'm sitting here and I'm really, really angry, which is my topic tonight. Or you can say, study the same phenomena in daily life. Say, boy, what do I do to keep from blowing my top, or how do I control that? Or, very interestingly, you can use anger as a subject of meditation. And what's the difference is that when it's a hindrance, when anger is a hindrance, it has control of you. You're not thinking about anything except the anger. Your mind's not clear. But when you can settle down enough, just kind of turn down the volume knob on it, then you can be kind of in the middle of anger, but still aware that you're in the middle of anger. And you can watch what's going on. So one is like being, you know, in a boat in a hurricane, just being tossed around, you're not knowing what's going on. Another one is looking at the high winds coming up and saying, oh, I wonder what happens if I move the sails. So that's kind of, so we'll talk about all of those tonight. And I should mention that as I was thinking about this talk, I was reading this book, which is so it's very much influenced by this book by Daniel Goleman. It's Destructive Emotions. If you don't know Daniel Goleman, he's a longtime Vipassana guy. He's kind of a closet Vipassana guy. He's mostly he got his PhD in psychology from Harvard, taught at Harvard. He's a columnist in the New York Times. Two-time Pulitzer Prize nominee. He's written several books, and he's now an academic psychologist again. But for his doctoral research from Harvard, he went to India to study meditation and as a phenomena, and he also ended up sitting. So when Joseph Goldstein was the first Westerner to sit with Munindraji in Bodh Gaya, Daniel Goleman was the second. So he knows what he's talking about, and it's a really interesting book. This is Daniel Goleman and three or four other guys getting together and sitting down talking with the Dalai Lama for a week about Western psychology, Western neural anatomy, all of that, and its and comparisons, the differences and similarities with Buddhist meditation. So anyway, that'll pop up tonight. So there's a couple ways to look at the hindrances. One way is you can look at them as a taxonomy of ways not to be present. So greed, sensual desire, and aversion in all its forms. And it can be fear. It can be just fidgety. I just don't want to sit here. It can be anger. Anything. So where you're grabbing onto something and pulling it to you, or something you're grabbing onto something and pushing it away. Those basically have the quality of you're fixated on something, but in a way that doesn't let you see what's going on clearly. And it's not clear, you know, there's a point where the emotion has you rather than you have the emotion. And that's when they're hindrances. And then sloth and torpor and restlessness and doubt, it's kind of when you're undershooting and overshooting the object of meditation. And they both have bodily and mental components. That's why they're two words. So sloth and torpor, you're tired and you don't feel like trying. And it's kind of like, you can't really, you can't mention, you can't pay attention to anything because it's just, you're going to sleep. Restlessness and remorse, you're planning for the future, you just can't get settled, you're kind of overshooting. And then there's doubt, which is, it's not just, gee, I wonder if I can sit till the bell rings. This is, I don't think I should sit at all. This doesn't make any difference. My future happiness doesn't depend on my actions, at least in the way that these guys say. It might depend on my actions in terms of getting a raise or something. But doubting the whole dharmic process, we don't even try. So that's one way of looking at it. Another way is kind of like the Buddha's five most wanted, or the yogi's five most wanted. I remember when I was a kid, I used to go in the post office every once in a while, and they'd have the FBI's 10 most wanted, and you'd have these pictures, you know, the guys, their eyes too close together, and, you know, 5 days of beard, or an artist's sketch, you know, because nobody had really seen them. And they would describe what these folks did. What was their crime? Well, their larceny, or bank robbery, or forging checks, or whatever. And their modus operandi. Oh, always rob banks in small town on Friday afternoon, or preys on, you know, swindles little old ladies out of money, you know, that kind of thing. Well, and the idea was that if a million people saw those things, one or two might actually find one of those guys. Well, the hindrances are kind of like that, but with some major differences. We're all going to see all five, we're all going to see the hindrances all the time, or at least they're going to be present for us quite often. The problem is, they're sitting right in front of us and we don't know it. And so it's more than just looking at a mugshot. We have to find some way to familiarize ourselves with the hindrances and what they look like to us, because they might look different to me than they do to you. And so that's that theme kind of getting to know the hindrances keeps on popping up. And there's a good story about it, but I want to tell one about myself first. When I was a kid, the family would go to church. My two brothers and I would sit with my mom up in the pews. And one Sunday a month, my dad would sit in the back as an usher. And he would sit in the back because people would come in late and he had to, you know, give them a program or take the collector or something. So I wouldn't see my dad for an entire hour. But I could tell immediately when he coughed. I mean, the room would be full of people, be fidgeting or rustling or people, whatever. But when my dad coughed, I knew immediately it was my dad. No doubt. And plus, I knew a whole lot more than just his cough. I knew what he looked like, I knew how he hugged me, etc. You know, I said, well, yeah, sure, of course. I mean, you lived with him, right? But I've lived with anger for far longer than I lived in my father's house, and I'm constantly surprised when I see it. I mean, on one hand, it's very familiar, and on the other hand, it always looks like something else. And that's where the modus operandi of the hindrances come in, is they use disguises. They're marvelous storytellers and mimics, and they work in teams. So I may be facing anger, but I don't see it as anger. I see it as this fascinating story about one of my favorite characters. It's me, and I can listen to stories about myself all day, especially when there's some emotional charge in there. But I won't see it for what it is. I'll see it for, this is the story of my life, or why I had to leave this job, or whatever. It's always got some story, and I'll see it for the story and not for the fundamental aspect of being grabbing onto something. It's kind of like grabbing onto a tar baby, who's got who. You know, grabbing onto something and being so latched up and your mind being so agitated by what you're watching that you're not really watching it, even though you're in its grip. So there's a story about the Buddha. on the night when he was enlightened, the Buddha got visited by Mara, who's the Buddhist devil figure. Except he's a god, but he's a really deluded god. He thinks that everybody ought to stay in the samsara, the wheel of death and rebirth. And he's doing his best to keep people there. And he tried to do that with the Buddha. And he went up and tempted him with the hindrances. Some of them, anyway. For sensual desire, he called forth his three daughters and had them do a nice dance and say, "Wouldn't you rather stay around for this?" For doubt, there's a picture. You often see the Buddha sitting like this with one hand over his knee, just touching the ground. That's when the Buddha, when Mara tempted the Buddha with doubt. He says, "Who are you to be enlightened?" And the Buddha just put his finger down, touched the earth, called forth the earth as his witness. And, rain showers or something like that, called the earth as his witness. And basically, I think that's about when the Mara went away, at least for the night. So that's why you see this picture of the Buddha with his finger touching the ground. But Mara didn't go away entirely. He kept on sneaking up on the Buddha. So the Buddha would be teaching in a group like this, or 500 people, and he'd look in the back and see Mara. He'd say, "Mara, I see you." And Mara would just take off. So what happened is the Buddha could catch Mara in a crowd of 500 people. "Oh, that's Mara. Yeah, I see." And that would be enough. Seeing him would be enough at the Buddha stage. Now, for us, just seeing what's going on and recognizing it, that would be a great trick, too. And part of what we need to do is just learn how to do that, so that we recognize what's going on. So what we'd like to do is get to the point where we can recognize the hindrances, or at least our favorite ones, like we see a good friend in a crowd. If you're at the mall and you see somebody, you can tell how they walk. You say, "That's Jamie. I know Jamie." Yeah, that's okay. But it's a long way before we do that for the hindrances, because of their ability to mask themselves and turn themselves into something else. The Tibetan word for meditation is really translated as familiarization. So when Tibetans are meditating, they're familiarizing themselves with their mind and its tricks and what the hindrances look like, or those things. And that's kind of partly what we do. If we go and we try and work with anger when it's just raging away, it's like, if you go to some theme park or something, you have these batting cages, and they can dial it and they'll throw a ball at 100 miles an hour, 90 miles, or 85 miles an hour. Well, if I stepped into one of those batting cages, I wouldn't do anything, So I'm kind of at the wiffle ball stage for a lot of these things. You put the wiffle ball up in a stick and you try and learn how to swing the bat straight. And that's fine. That's, if that's where we are with a particular difficulty on any given day, you start where you are. That's what we need to do. You learn how to swing the bat straight, then you work with a moving ball, etc. So if we learn how to deal with aversion, say we're starting to fidget or something like that, maybe you try and sit with it and you say, "Yeah, that was optional. I really didn't have to do that. In fact, I could kind of see the urge to fidget come. And that was kind of cool. I could just see it come." And then you work with that. And then maybe I was driving in tonight, I saw a guy who was going to pull out of a parking lot ahead of me on the highway. He says, "No, you don't." I just, one of these things, beam, rays at him or something like that. But it happened kind of in stages. I could see the bodily sensation come up. And then I caught it before the story started to kick in. The self-justification is like, "Hey, I'm on my way. I was here before you," et cetera, et cetera. And, once I get into that stage and the story starts kicking in, I don't tell myself stories I'm not interested in. So I always have good stories, and I can repeat them all night. I've worked these things out over years. But I saw it before the story started to kick in, and I thought, this doesn't really feel that good. So you start to, that's part of the familiarization, you start to pick it apart and say, "Oh, this is made of pieces, and if you catch it early enough before the before the gratification comes in, you notice that maybe maybe that anger isn't all that fun, and instead of getting involved and being all important, on your way to give a talk and all that, you realize, that's really kind of childish. He pulls in there, and you would have still gotten there at the time. Maybe he's, shouldn't do that so often. I think it's Ruth Dennison has a phrase. It says, "Self-understanding is never good news." It's maybe overstated, but sometimes you just have to develop self-acceptance too, along with it. So, working with the hindrances covers a lot of territory, as I mentioned before. The hindrances are properly, the hindrance is proper, in the most restricted sense of aversion, being on the cushion. It brings us right into the right effort. It's one of the steps of the Eightfold Path. And there are four right efforts. And those have to do with things that are, with mental states that have not yet arisen and ones that have. And it sounds really simple. I mean, it's like, oh, yeah, sure. But when you start picking it apart, it makes sense. So the four are starting with positive states. If you have a positive state, mental state, like equanimity or loving kindness or whatever, or just plain concentration, how do you keep it going? If you don't have one, how do you cook one up? Then for the negative mental states, if you don't have a negative mental state like anger or fear or something like that, what do you do to keep it from happening? And most important for the aversions, for aversion as a hindrance when it's really got you on the pillow, what happens if you have an unskillful mental state like anger? How do you get rid of it? And the Buddha gave several different tips here. One of these, one of these is, then with his teeth clenched and his tongue pressed against the roof of his mouth, he should beat down, constrain, and crush his mind with awareness. Fortunately, that's number five, and we can start with number one and two. That's for advanced students. Numbers one and two are trying to replace the unskillful feeling with a positive one, or contemplating the drawbacks of that unskillful feeling. So, if I'm having a really hard time with a memory of a certain interaction with a certain person, I can try and do metta for that person. Try and understand, just extend loving kindness to him, or maybe I do something a little more psychological, like try and understand that he's got his problems too, without getting into the pity for him. But just if I can do something to kind of take away my story and include some of his, maybe I can drain off some of the anger. Or if it doesn't really, I'm just in a state of anger, and that doesn't work, and maybe this guy is really, really hard to extend loving kindness to. Maybe you can just reflect on the states, on the drawbacks of being angry. It's ruining your day. It's detracting from your meditation. It's ruining your judgment. Whatever. And that shows up in daily life as well. Excuse me while I read my notes here. Yeah, so it's often in daily life that morality, or sila as we call it, and also psychology overlap. And that can be, so a lot of the techniques that we learn in, as we sit here, kind of overlap and reinforce a lot of the kind of the psychology, the psychology or the pop psychology that we all know about. And that's fine, because we all come to practice because we suffer. I mean, none of us are really here because, maybe some of you are here for curiosity, but if you're, we mostly come here because we suffer. And a lot of our suffering can be helped by psychological means. I'm not a psychologist, but by giving ourselves a better story about something. Or noticing how we keep on repeating the same things and keep on creating the same state for us and replacing it with something else. That's fine. You start where you are, and if that's what you need so you can start meditating more, that's fine. My first several years of retreats were spent rewriting my career and lots of things. Oh, if only this had gone different. And I had many wonderful lifetimes that I just never got to, but I spent. And I just had to go through that. I don't think it was particularly a Dharma exercise. It happened to be in a setting with people that were very supportive of me and had their act together and could help me. And then we have the hindrances, the objects of meditation. And if we can, as I mentioned before, if we get enough ability here on the cushion while things are fairly controlled situation, we can look at things in their follow them from the junior league through the farm teams. Maybe by the time they get to the big leagues, we're able to handle them in big life. Trying to see, can't see the clock out there. So is it? Okay, never mind. So then I'd like to. So when is aversion with a small a aversion with a big A? That's one of the things we want to get into and talk a little bit about it. Pardon?
8:25.
Great, thanks. So the question is, when is aversion with a small a aversion with a big A? Because there's some of the terms that we use, colloquially, don't map exactly on to the Buddhist vocabulary. So it's what a lot of us think of as aversion or just plain the hindrances are things we think of as something as a destructive emotion. Kind of if it interrupts our personal happiness or our interpersonal relationships. So anger for a lot of us is a problem because it gets in the way of our effectiveness at work or our relationship, or we just feel lousy after we blow our top or something like that. In the Buddhist understanding, or at least as the Dalai Lama was talking about it in here, that's really not the point. For the Dalai Lama, anger is a problem because it keeps us from seeing clearly and it upsets our mind. So for a lot of us, we want to get rid of just enough anger so I can get the job done or get along with the guy at the next desk or whatever. But in the Buddhist scheme of things, anger, even in its most subtle manifestation, if that is keeping us from seeing things clearly or unsettling the mind, it's a problem. That's why it's one of the last things to go away. I think that you have to be an arhat before it goes away completely. You can do things along the way and get pretty calm and mellow, but before it goes away and completely, you're all the way to the end of the path. So I want to contrast a couple of statements. This knee pain is killing me. That's attributed to Don Johnson. The second one is, this body should be regarded as impermanent, as painful, a boil, a dart, a calamity, an affliction, as alien, as disintegrating, as void, as not self. And that's the Buddha. And what's the difference between them? They both look like this body is just a problem. Well, the Buddha's understanding was a lot more sophisticated than mine. He saw through all of the all the stories I would tell about myself, all the eye-making. When I say it's killing me, well, I've got a definite opinion about me and about what should happen, and about, and somewhere in there is some idea about my permanence, and some stories about suffering that it really shouldn't be here. So when I'm doing that kind of aversion, I'm not seeing dukkha, I'm not seeing anicca, and I'm not seeing anatta. I'm not seeing suffering or unsatisfactoriness. I'm not seeing impermanence, and I'm not seeing the fact that there's no permanent self inside of this seemingly consistent and perpetuating cloud of thoughts and chemicals and stuff. And then then there's another thing we can talk about is when is. So if not all aversions are really aversions with a capital A, what about anger as righteous anger or helpful anger? I mean, this comes up a lot. When you talk about anger and get rid of it, people say, no, wait a second, I need anger. There's so much wrong in the world today. I mean, pick your topic, right? There's if I weren't angry, I couldn't get anything done. I mean, I need this. Anger would be, I'll get rid of most of it, but I got to keep some of it because I'm not a monk, I'm a householder, I'm politically active or whatever. Well, what you have there, I mean, maybe anger acts like an early warning system or radar or something. It says, well, gee, when my forehead feels hot and flush like this, something's important, I should pay attention to it. But if you use anger to guide your actions, I tell you, when you're angry is one of the worst times to make an important decision, because you're going to be making it. I mean, you may have picked your issue well, but you've probably also picked your action poorly. So what about these wrathful deities? You see, the Tibetans have them. There's one. One statue I've seen of a Japanese bodhisattva, Fudo or something. He's standing there with a sword like this, and he's got his tongue out and flames coming out. And he's a bodhisattva with a sword, and he's angry. What's the story? Well, at his level, he's got some of the physical affects of anger, and he's got the determination and incisiveness and the singleness of mind, but he doesn't have the delusion. And he doesn't have the unsettled mind. So I think there's something, maybe there are parts of anger that are useful as an early warning system, or the story that comes up a lot is a mother running to catch her kid before he steps into traffic and shaking him or something like that. No, she was pretty clear about what was going on, and that, in that case it was appropriate. But it wasn't like being angry at the neighbors. So, I throw that in. Let's see. I think I've already mentioned this, that kind of in the secular West, we describe a destructive emotion as having a bad effect on relationships or our feelings, whereas a more dhammic sense would be it clouds our vision. And there's also, what's the goal of the process? I think that for a lot of the secular goals, it's to be normal. And for Freud, the goal of a lot of these processes that look like we're understanding ourselves was just normal neuroses. But for our practice, it's a complete elimination of destructive emotions, even if slowly, even if we have to go through these first stages first. So here's a quote from this book. One of these authors, one of the guys in the seminar said, "In the Western perspective, being normal is fine. From a Buddhist perspective, being normal means that you're now ready to practice the Dharma." So, oh well. Seemed important when I wrote it down. Let's see. I'd like to start referring a little more directly to the book now, and mention another name. Another one of the guys in the book is Paul Ekman, and he's a senior research psychologist at the University of California in San Francisco. He's been studying emotions for 40 years. Maybe some of you have seen in books or articles or something about his work with facial expressions. And he goes way back. And he was one of the people at this seminar. And he was invited to the seminar because he was, you know, at least sympathetic to hearing what the Dalai Lama had to say. But he was also, he was invited primarily because of his scholastic work as understanding emotions, in this case, destructive emotions. And he had a schema. He said there were like three different stages in an emotion. One was assessment, like, like, that guy cut in front of me, that jerk. Another one was impulse, like, I had to tell him about it. I had to go up and confront him with his, his failure as a human being. And another one was the actual action, was doing it. And later in the book, there's a fourth stage that kind of sneaks in, and that's perception. Other people put it in. Paul Ekman didn't. So there's perception, assessment, or cognition, if you want. There's intention, and then there's action. And so what I'd like to do is work backward through the series and look at a couple different ways to do it. And we'll just talk about anger and meditation and some things that came up in this book. So on the stage between impulse and action. So for us, I want to read this from Paul Ekman. Said, more than 40 years ago when I was a psychotherapist, my teacher said to me, your goal is for your patients to increase the time between impulse and action. If they have spread that time, this is what they will have gained. What the Dalai Lama is talking about in terms of, increasing the appraising time before the impulse, it says, can't read my own writing. But the whole, let's see, 144. I'll read it from here. What His Holiness is talking about is increasing the appraising time before the impulse. It is not the time from impulse to action, but from appraising to impulse. This is an extraordinary and very important difference. So I think for Paul Ekman it's a big thing, but if we look at our own practice, that kind of comes with the territory. We start to do that. I'm getting ahead of myself. The impulse to action part. If we're looking there, that's where right speech, right action, right livelihood come in. Mindfulness and clear comprehension comes in there. There's clear comprehension. There's actually it's not just a nice phrase, it's actually in the commentary, it's actually blown out into a list of four things. So clear comprehension, sampajana, jhana, is full awareness of, one, first, the purpose of one's action. That is, I was in a phone call last night, and I was upset at this guy. I was calling him up as a local politician, and I was trying to explain a situation to him, and he just kind of blew me off. It was a complex. He said, write me a one-page document and get it to me and all that. I had all kinds of thoughts about how, if I could write this a one-page document that explained it all, he wouldn't need to be in office. But I didn't say that because I was pretty clear about my purpose was I needed his vote rather than his approval. So just a little bit there. I mean, it sounds simple, but I skip that step a lot. And I go to I've got one of my stories in my storehouse is, righteous action that clears away all confusion, and it never happens that way. But I keep on trying. So another one is, are intentions pure or are they mixed? And You might ask yourself that sometimes. Sometimes that takes a little of the steam out of your emotions. Another thing is the suitability of one's actions. This is not the end justifies the means. Sometimes the best thing to do is just be quiet. If you can't do anything good, you just be quiet. Another one I look at it, it helps me, is am I trying something that I can't expect to work? I mean, maybe I'm just setting myself to be madder because something doesn't fail. It's some old pattern I'm replaying and it just doesn't work. So is that suitable? Clear comprehension of the object of meditation. It might be your breath, it might be your body. There's sometimes just paying attention to your body, especially when you're talking. If you can just pay attention to clues in your body, it helps a bit, helps a lot. I often recognize it too late, you know, when I've just said something I really shouldn't have, and I realize I have a temperature, or my jaw is tense, or my shoulders are up. But you can, if whatever works for you, if that helps. And then the last one is clear comprehension of reality. And this is, the Buddha's kept on reminding his disciples, he says, this is not me, this is not mine, this is not who I am. I mean, it sounds like, yeah, sure, right? It's real easy to say that now, but when you get out, well, the more you try it, the more it makes sense. So try it out, some simple things, and you say, well, yeah, okay, maybe I can let that one go. I might not be, you know, really into no self or something like that, but I, you know, that makes enough sense. It worked on something smaller, I'll try it on something bigger, and this might work for you. So those are the kind of the, where we talk about going from impulse to action. And those are some of the tools that we have that the Buddha gave us. Then there's going from assessment to impulse. Making a decision that we like something or we don't like something, and then actually deciding that we need to do something about it. And our tool there is contemplation of the body, or contemplation of the feelings, actually, vedana nupassana. And you know, it sounds really simple when the Buddha talks about it. He asks us to talk about noticing whether something is pleasant, unpleasant, or neither pleasant or unpleasant. But there's a lot there. Because, try it. When I try it, I look at something and I don't get just plain pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. I get that with a story. You know, like, I have a special relationship with my dentist. I've put at least one of his kids through college. And you know, a little tooth pain will flare up, and it's never just a sensation of heat or pressure. I mean, there's always a story with it, always. But the Buddha kept on going, no, keep on trying. Look back at the assessment, the primitive cognition, without the story. So we can try that, and every once in a while we'll get a little closer to it. Sometimes this happens with I think knee pain is a great kind of laboratory for working with things. It doesn't help because, you know, if you have knee pain, you're going to, you know, gain merit, and you know, it's training pain. You know, if it's really going to damage you, don't do it. But if it's like, oh well, I can try this for a little bit longer, you can get to the place where you can truly see the difference between pain and suffering. I mean, you can see the pain as clear as day, but it's somebody else's pain. I mean, not indifferent to it, but not identified with it either. So you can kind of get tease apart what for most of us is kind of like a one-stop emotion kind of thing, and say, well, gee, you know, this, there are options here. There's more flexibility here. There are pieces, there are moving parts in here. I can take this apart. Some of them I don't have to have, at least some of the time. But once you see something like that, even if you see it once, or once in a while, He's like, oh yeah, that I never knew it could be like that. And, you know, this, I've heard about it, but I see it now. And then that starts making a difference. On the other hand, and part of this is because I'm trying to figure out why, on one hand, some of the psychological methods seem so valuable and fit in so well, and on the other hand, why they seem like they're kind of, my Dhamma practice kind of pulls me off into another direction. And, I mean, I've needed every bit of help I got. And I've seen things, for example, if, let me make up a story here. Let's say you have a problem with somebody at work. And this guy, you don't know why this guy really bothers you. And you just can't get along with him and you have to because he's your boss or whatever. And then, or maybe in a relationship, whatever. But then you realize that this guy reminds you of Jimmy Schindelbeck from sixth grade. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and when you lost the spelling bee because you misspelled tomato, and he never let you forget it, and that little sneer all through junior high, and this guy looks just like that. Well, there may be something freeing there, right? And we've had that. I can make up other stories about, but there's that one there. And it's, oh, isn't that great? I just figured this out. But what happened was aversion just went off the stage, changed clothes, and came back. You know, there's aversion to our boss, just turned into aversion for Jimmy Schindelbeck. It may be there may be something freed up in there, but we thought that this new form of aversion was a major insight. It's just aversion. I mean, it may help us a lot. We may get along with our boss, which is not to be not to be downplayed, but it's not the fundamental revisioning of how we think that I think this practice offers us. And now we're last card here, perception to assessment. Remember I said that there's perception to assessment to impulse into action. And in the book here, Paul Ekman, who's no slouch, been thinking about this for a long time, he didn't really think that we could get the time down between assessment and impulse. He thought that was too short for people to see. Now there's another one in here, the difference between perception and assessment, or perception and cognition. And this comes in later in the book, when some of the presenters are guys from University of Wisconsin that have like $10 million of sophisticated hardware and software for doing EEGs, and they can some EEGs they just measure the surface of the scalp, some the more probes can get down to three-dimensionally, and then depending on the hardware and software, it's, you know, what's the time resolution? So the story goes that in here they're talking. One of the presenters is talking to the Dalai Lama and says, you know, we have things down to 200 milliseconds, which is 0.2 of a second. And we can see the difference between, you know, when we show somebody a face, people who are in a bad mood that day react differently than people who are in a good mood. There's a face or something, I don't know. But they could see. And maybe the face didn't mean anything to him, but it was just that there's a lot of the reaction would depend on the person's emotions, their mood, or their temperament. So the Dalai Lama said, well, I wonder, is there something that happens, say, maybe at 100 milliseconds, that's the same from person to person? And then another guy raised his hand and says, yeah, in my lab, we can see down to 70 to 100 milliseconds. And there's something happening there in the brainstem. That's, you know, not the cortex or the frontal or anything. There's something happening there in the brainstem around 0.1 of a second or less. It seems to be the same from person to person. What it seems to be is just cognition. It's just, you know, with no value added. It's just a plain thing. And the Dalai Lama says, that's it. And if you've read some of the things or heard some of the more complicated explanations of the suttas, that's what the Buddha's talking about. He breaks things down. He talks about it. There's the mind moments and all of that. What they're starting to see, what they're starting to recognize in the lab is what the Buddha and the Dalai Lama and Gil and everybody else has been talking about. There's a place that we can get to with our own minds. We can see in our own minds how we construct the world around us. We can see, we can see the thoughts form and blossom and go away. We can see things on a level that's below philosophy or ideology or our personalities or stories or culture. It's down where the building blocks of being conscious are. And the Buddha points us at that. And this practice helps us get there. By looking at knee pain or by paying attention and see if we can notice the impulse to move before we move, whether it's sitting here or in walking meditation, by noticing that the thought we had when somebody's going to pull ahead of us isn't just one thing, but it's made up of parts, and that it's easier for me to deal with things if I can deal with the parts. So the practice offers those things to us, and whether it's aversion or fear or greed, any of the other mental states we have to work through, we can use the same tools for all of them. That is, the great thing is we don't have to change tools depending on what the job is, because the tools we've got just work for everything. And the more we use them, the better they get. So that's about what I wanted to say. I can't really see the time. Do we have time for questions or to sit? Oh, okay. We're talking about perception here. I'm sitting close to the clock. I can't see the clock. Okay. This meeting with the Dalai Lama is one of a series that's been going on for about 10 or 15 years. And if you're interested in that, you can pick up that. And there's books on most of them. Some of them are on cosmology and the Buddha, some are Buddhism, some are on compassion and altruism, etc. Yeah, please.
You may have already addressed this a little bit, but in trying to improve how one deals with anger, mm-hmm. there's lengthening time between perception and assessment of these different areas. What would be a good place for a beginner to start, either based on the high impact area or the place where somebody new to this might be likely to change what he's doing?
What a high impact area would...
That would affect, well, not leading to wrong action.
Yeah. Kind of the way this works, at least in my experience, is... it kind of sneaks up on you. You don't, whatever luck I've had with anger didn't necessarily mean, okay, I'm going to work on anger. It might have been, I have to work with boredom, or I have to work with knee pain, or whatever. Because you don't really get to choose what comes up, and that's the only thing you can really work with. And, it may be, it may be that you really feel pressed for time in the morning, so we'll notice that. If that's it, you say, no, I can't really sit 20 minutes this morning. I really have to get up because it's really more important to get up. Well, just how does that feel in your body? Or notice the thought when it comes up. Just, that's the only thing you can work with. And also... don't be surprised if things start to seem like they're getting worse, because you say, "Oh, gee, I didn't realize I'm angrier or whatever this that or the other thing. This thing I must be doing it backwards." No, what's happening is that was there all the time. You're just kind of tuning into it. So give yourself some slack for that. And there's kind of like a little shuffle between self-understanding and self-awareness. And when self-understanding pulls ahead a little too far ahead of the self-awareness, you get one of those, oh, I'm doing it wrong, or what a jerk I am. And then you get the other one, and the person, you get some self-understanding, you hit it, and then it'll catch up. So it goes like that. So just the practice works. I don't know how, but it does. And if you do your best with whatever's there for you at the time, it'll just give it a chance, and it'll make a difference. Please. Oh, yeah. I think what I was talking about is that when we say anger, we may have, we may think of anger, clenching our fist and turning beet red and stuff like that. But it can be any form of aversion. It might not have necessarily be anger, although I did use that word, I think. You may think, I can't get too subtle because I'm not so bad. But I may think, for example, we've got some political figures that some people are just a real problem, and they have there's no problem. I mean, they get really mad about it, make all kinds of judgments. And I think, well, I don't get there. I don't say how arrogant this particular man is, or how incredibly stupid this one is. But I've got it. But I'm one size down. I said, oh, that poor guy. And it's still judgment and aversion or whatever, even though I don't show it at the same level that maybe somebody else does. And then there's somebody else another size down from me, and say, Don's still stuck in judgment. And then somebody else is saying, yeah, you too. So it's like an onion. It just keeps on going, but. It's like that, and the good thing is, once you solve one thing, then you got something else to work on. So, is that close to an answer? Okay, please.
I was really interested in this talk tonight because our culture is such a lot of culture. We have violent video games.
Yeah.
A lot of violence on TV. We have violence in the schools. We have violence in the workplace. It's all over the place, and it's really, it is difficult to sit on a cushion and, duke it out with yourself, you're dealing with those issues that you have in yourself. And then interacting in the world, there's all kinds of anger if it comes to you through racial slurs or ageism, sexism, there's all these, I don't know if this is a subtle form of anger, but it's present in so many ways all around us, and it's such a challenge to try to walk through the world, especially here, for me, I feel like. I guess everywhere is relevant, but the United States is we're surrounded by it. You go to the Blockbuster video store and look at what's available, and it's like, wow, it's murder.
Right.
And I don't know, it's a culture that we have, and to take myself into the workplace, if I am totally at peace, I guess there's a harmony. Hopefully that's contagious. But some people will just bully you and peck at you until you stand up for yourself.
Yeah. And how do you do that?
Take the schools, for example, children, have to deal with this at a real visceral level.
Yeah. Let me see if I can. So far what I've understood is that, and this isn't exactly what you're saying, but so far what I've understood is that if I try and make this, the society, the system's problem, or their problem, or something like that, I'm losing a chance to work on it because I really can't do a whole lot about these other things. To the extent that something's going on with society, I'm part of it and I'm feeding it. And that doesn't mean to be apathetic or not do anything. A year ago, I spent a lot of time lobbying the Board of Supervisors about a certain resolution we wanted them to pass. And I felt really, it was about the Patriot Act. And I felt very strong about this. But I noticed that when my own feelings about this took over and clouded my judgment or my relations with other people, as strongly as I felt about it, what I really had to feel more strongly about was my own equilibrium, my own ability to get along with these other people in this organization, you know, all grassroots organizations that are dysfunctional. You know, how do you deal with that? Sitting down with a supervisor and trying to lobby him without, you know, lecturing him and all that. I had to work on that. That, you know, there are probably more skillful, you know, better things around to do, but that was the only thing I could do. I mean, that's kind of where I am right now. I really don't know what to do about the kids. I'm not a parent. I'm sorry, I don't have an answer. But all the problems, I was thinking of a story. Somebody was, you know, newly into the practice and had all these great ideas and wanted to talk to people about how they could change their lives if they just practiced like this or whatever. And soon found out that she was more interested in talking about he was more interested in talking about things than were his or her friends. So he just cooled it. And but continued their practice. And over time, you know, the people said, well, hey, you know, you took that a lot better than I would have thought you did, thought you would have, or something like, you know, this kind of showed up in the relationships, and maybe every once in a while it deserved a remark. And the way this person kind of netted it out is, you know, my friends liked me a lot more when I was a Buddha than when I was a Buddhist. And I think that's kind of the way I look at things. I know people are into, there's a lot of people doing great things in engaged Buddhism, but there's you don't necessarily need an analysis of the world based on dependent origination to get a petition signed or anything like that. It has a lot to do with your own equilibrium, your own ability to bounce back from disappointment. One of the big issues is, How do you be active? How can you be active in something that you know can only turn out bad or worse? I mean, there's no improvement, like population or ecology or something like that. Those aren't going to get better for a long, long time. How do you give yourself over to that and still be hopeful and active, and not get worn out and bitter? And I think you have to just get used to looking at things. And even things that are bad, you know, like knee pain, it's not like, oh, hey, I've looked at it, good, I can go away now. No, that may stay there. You may look at that for a long time, and someday it won't stop. I don't know. Sometimes you just don't know, and you got to do the best you can. Like the first question, like, what do you do? How do I address this problem over here? Well, I don't know, just... But if you're antsy and you want to get off the pillow, maybe that's where you start. You know, it's not a very satisfying answer, but it's the only one I have or know how to make work.
Have you heard about those studies they bring these groups of monks into these violent neighborhoods? And it's, you know, the violent crime goes right now.
Hmm.
And
yeah.
Not yet.
Yeah. Maybe that's how it works. Yeah. Well, yeah, there's something, I can believe that. Yeah, and maybe we just do that one-on-one or something like that. I know that getting together in a group like this with other people, I feel better in a group where I feel better and healed and empowered if I'm spend some time working with people that kind of have their stuff together. Even if it means that we're together to work on something where things are, everything is screwed up. We can talk more later, I think. But it's 9. I think the evening's over. Thank you very much.